tonight on The Download, DePaul women's basketball coach Doug Bruno, from the new CISO show Shrink, the creator Tim Paltz, and live music in Studio 435 from The Walters. And now here's your host, a man who finally gets to wear his snow boots tonight, Justin Kaufman.
It's true. Finally get to wear them. Got them for Christmas. I was so excited. All I did is trip up on Michigan Avenue a couple times. But now, they're useful for a day or two. Welcome to another episode of The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got a great show. We're excited to kick off the week with you. Of course, we say this every week, but I am honored to be on the air here in the Chicago area. And if you're driving home, or maybe you're already at work, or maybe, you know, listening as you finish up dinner, put the dishes away, that kind of thing, argue about the dishes, I'm here for you. The Download. We got a great show tonight. I'm very excited about tonight's show. It's a good Monday to start off. Doug Bruno is going to join us. Coach Bruno, of course, the DePaul women's basketball head coach. He is the coach. He's been there for years. Olympic gold medal winner, as well as I think it's 15 years straight. He has brought the DePaul Blue Demons women's basketball program to the NCAA tournament. For as much as we talk about it, and rightfully so, this story is great about Northwestern. It's unbelievable. The idea that Northwestern will be the first team in, what, 3 or 4 years that from Chicago that has been in a tournament, to have that juxtaposed against the women's side where DePaul has been there 15 years in a row. It's pretty impressive, and Coach Bruno has been there for all of that. We'll talk with him. He'll be my guest at the big table, talk about athletics. We'll talk a little Title IX. We'll talk a little bit about the success and what makes a great student athlete. Doug Bruno will be my guest. My favorite part about it, kind of mentioned this in the crosstalk, is that, you know, they just did the selection show for women's tonight. They did it an hour ago. And my favorite part is I missed the DePaul. I saw them flash up DePaul, like they're the 7 seed, right? But I didn't get the chance to see them, you know, sort of do the reaction shot of the kids and all that. So I just have this idea in my head of, you know, the reaction shot happening and the Paul Blue Demon jumping up and down and Coach Bruno being like, well, I got to go do the download. This is real fun, everybody. Back here tomorrow for practice, but hey, got to get going. They want me downtown. So clean this up. All of this, clean it up. Doug Bruno will be my guest at the big table tonight. 7:30, it is time for Touche, and what a night to talk national politics. The Congressional Budget Office comes out with a not a stellar report when it comes to the new health care plan. I like to call Trump Care, just for the fun of it. Come on, really? It's so fun. No, it's not. Please don't call it that. Oh, really? Is that what we're doing now? We're not calling it by the president's name anymore? Okay, it's Trump Care. That it would cost a ton more in insurance. We'll talk with Chris Roebling and Kitty Kurth, who is in for Dave Lundy tonight. So a little arguing to start off your Monday, a little pepper. I like to call it, you know, in baseball, they have pepper. You play pepper, throw the ball around. It's like pepper, but arguing about politics. Same concept. That's what we're doing with Touche. That's 7:30. Also tonight, Tim Baltz is here. Tim Baltz, one of the great Second City performers. He just came through Second City probably in the last decade, and he has moved out to Los Angeles, and he's had a ton of success, including, I'm so excited about this, he's got his own show debuting this week on CISO. It's called Shrink. I watched the first episode on Amazon last night. Hilarious. It's his idea. It's a great concept. He is a therapist in training. He needs clinical hours to be able to complete his work to become a therapist. So he does free sessions in his parents' garage. And all of his, like a lot of the comedy comes from, you know, the back and forth with the clients. And all of the clients are Chicago actors. Like, I mean, it's just a who's who of Chicago improv and comedy that is on display in the new show Shrink, which will be in CISO this week. It's debuting. You can catch the first episodes on Amazon right now. So we'll talk with Tim, who's back in town. So great to have him in studio. And also tonight, Studio 435, the Walters in studio. Excited to have the Indie Rockers here. They're playing at Metro coming up this week with the Orwells, and then they're heading out on tour. Great. They're getting a lot of buzz. Great to have the Walters in studio tonight. And also tonight, pay a tribute to my friend Amy Cross Rosenthal, who passed away today. So we'll talk about that as well. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get the show on the road, shall we? It's time for the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The Congressional Budget Office put out a report on the new health care plan put forth by congressional Republicans. And lo and behold, it says that 24 million Americans will become uninsured. What? Wah, wah. That was me trying to do sound effects. But what's 24 million, right? I mean, this country's huge, right? Am I right? High five. Wait, where did all my congressional Republicans buddies go? No high fives? Nobody? Huh. Of course, the White House dismisses the report, attacking the Congressional Budget Office, as they have been leading up to today. Although the CBO is currently run by a Republican, but maybe the wrong Republican, right? That's what we're doing now? Just... It's not enough that it's a Republican. It's the wrong Republican. I don't know. All I know is this strikes a blow to the new Trump Care plan. And yes, even though the White House doesn't want us to call it that, I'm calling it Trump Care. It's Trump Care. Trump Care, Trump Care, Trump Care. Because last time I checked, I'm not sure President Obama was ever like, you know what? Let's call it by my name. I don't remember that. In other news over the weekend, new Attorney General Jeff Sessions called for the resignations of 46 U.S. District Attorneys, holdovers from the Obama years. This means Zach Farden here in the Illinois area is out. He was just getting started, too. But you know what? We don't need U.S. attorneys wasting taxpayer dollars trying to root out corrupt politicians. That's so 2010. It's all cleaned up. Dems are up in arms. But then again, it's a Republican administration, and you didn't see this one coming, right? I mean, this isn't the first time it happens when a regime changed, but then again, it is Trump, so I get it. So I guess it's time you just hit up Facebook with your opinion. I am so Trumped. Trump. The White House has asked Congress for more time when it comes to revealing evidence of President Obama wiretapping that the President Trump alleged on Twitter. Sean Spicer's backing off the claim, too, saying maybe Trump didn't mean wiretapping. Maybe it meant something different. Oh, right. So eavesdropping, like in the back of an elevator? Or like a call waiting snafu, like on that episode of Seinfeld? Are you, who's it? No, Jerry! Are we talking like the good old-fashioned glass-to-door trick? We need answers here. What does wiretapping mean to you, Trump? A new study says that at least half of the melting of the Arctic ice caps may just be natural. What? So that news just in time for your next family get-together. I smell a climate change fight at Easter, everybody. Another study says that infant injuries are up due to faulty nursery products like strollers, buggies, and walkers. For the amount of money those things cost, you'd think that we would be paying closer attention to faulty products. This is ridiculous. That stuff is super mad expensive. I don't know how many people are like, you know what? I'll take the $5 one with the missing wheel. No, don't worry about it. Just cash out. I mean, seriously, you pay a lot of money for that stuff. The fact that it's injuring your toddler, where's Trump? That should be priority number one. Forget this healthcare stuff. Well, I guess the healthcare could work. This weekend was the St. Patrick's Day celebration, since it was the weekend before the Friday holiday. Oh, that explains why I have this $100 charge for vomit cleanup on my bank statement. Just, it's what happens when you drink green beer at 7 in the morning. I don't know. In weather, what's that? What's this powder? This white clumpy rain that's all over the place. You call it here snow? I think that's what it is, snow. And before we jump to climate change talk, there's always this storm in March, right? How many St. Patrick's days do you remember with like either crappy freezing rain / snow or freezing temperature, and you're like, wow, I wish I had gloves. Like that's like that should be the St. Patrick's Day motto. I wish I wore gloves. But 500 flights canceled through all of the Northeast. Of course, more snow on the way. This could be worse, of course. We could be living in Boston. They're saying historic and life-threatening blizzard. Really? Like more historic than like Valley Forge? Like the most historic storm of all time, right? And you know what, damn? George Washington lived through that. Boston, you can live through this. In sports, the Northwestern Wildcats going to the big dance. The Cats made their first ever tournament. They're the 8 seed. I love that they're in. Not too happy that their potential second round matchup is Gonzaga. Eesh. Well, they play Thursday afternoon against Vanderbilt, who's coached by local product and March Madness hero Bryce Drew. Valpo, anybody? So it's no guarantee that the Cats can make it to the second round, but if they play like they played against Maryland in the Big Ten tourney, they're going to lose by 8 to Gonzaga. Speaking of magical runs, the Bulls have lost 5 in a row, although they're winning tonight. Yesterday, they sought out new lows, only scoring 26 points in the entire first half against the Celtics. I mean, it was like a laughingstock. It was a nationally televised game. They went to the halftime, and they didn't even talk about the game. They talked about other stuff. They're like, the Bulls, okay, they scored 26 points. It's ridiculous. They looked listless the entire game. D-Wade and Butler were non-factors in this potential first-round playoff matchup. But then again, playoffs, really? Is that what we're talking about? The Bulls have slipped to the 10th seed in the East, and they're fading away from competition for the bottom. You know what's a joke about it is they're not bottom enough. You know, like if they're really going to tank it out, tank to get to the bottom. This sort of C-plus tanking doesn't do anybody any good. Just missing the playoffs in the NBA? That's recipe for a sloppier Doug McDermott draft pick in a year. It's ridiculous. Also, D-Wade's got to lose the undershirt. He's wearing with the long-sleeve undershirt. He looks like the guy in the pool that won't take off the shirt. You know what I mean? Come on, you're a superstar. Show off those pecs. Show me a bicep. Bears free agency haul looks to be complete. A quarterback, 2 wide receivers, a tight end, 2 cornerbacks, and a safety. Seems like the right areas to focus on, although each player that was just mentioned was picked as a second or third choice. Look at that. That's not good. Nothing like bargain hunting when you got $60 million to spend. So I guess that's a win for ownership. Yeah, more golfing. They could take the extra millions and throw a huge Lake Michigan salsa yacht party. Now all eyes on the draft in April. Will the Bears pick up a rookie quarterback to build around? I hope so, because right now, who's the star on this squad? Who do you put on the big billboards? I saw Kyle Long on a Ford billboard on the Kennedy, I guess. Always strong when your front-facing star is an offensive lineman. Doesn't touch the ball all game long. Never good. That's not good. All right, so I guess they're better than Cutler. I mean, that was the star before. He's rumored to be wanted by the Jets, although that's lukewarm. Also, the Packers signed Martellus Bennett to play tight end. Great, now we got to watch him slowly saunter back to the huddle 2 times a year. Come on, Martellus, speed it up. Let's go. Hawks got a big win against the Wild yesterday, continuing their regular season success against their front runner. Right now, the Hawks trailing the Wild by a point. Winner gets the top seed. I love it. Hockey, baby! That's great. What a showdown, huh? And finally tonight, a Texas lawmaker just put in a bill that would fine men $100 every time they masturbate. Yep. It's a protest bill to shed light over the politics, over reproductive rights. I mean, I guess that's a good idea, but I feel bad. I feel bad for the cops that are going to have to enforce this, right? What are you doing in there? Nothing. $100 right there. That's the carryout for March 13, 2017. Hey, great. Snow. Right when we ordered all these popsicles. Coming up, Kitty Kurth in for Dave Lundy. Kitty Kurth and Chris Roebling take on what the CBO said about Trump Care. And, of course, all the weekend's news and national politics. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Oh, man, I am so good. How are you?
How are the boots, the snow boots?
Fantastic.
Yeah, right.
So I broke him out today, buddy.
I know.
Well, you saw me coming in.
Yeah, I did.
In.
Yeah, we came in together. I was like, hey.
That's right.
That's why I made a joke at the beginning. I'm like, today's the day for the snow boots finally.
Clomping around, absolutely.
Feels good, right? They feel good.
It
they
does.
Feel snug.
Well, and you know, I was all excited, too, because I finished my inside chores, and then I looked outside, but by the time I got around to looking outside, about 2/3 of my driveway had already melted away, the snow that had fallen. So,
well, maybe you get lucky. Maybe you get lucky with a little lake
effect. I hope so, man. I need about 20 inches. Just want to get out there and have
just
at it.
Just to pay off the, make it the investment for the snowblower.
Take that, old man, winter. got a two-cycle I'm going to throw at you, my Sorel boots.
Oh, yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, You got a video, Dad? Put that up on the GN page.
I might. I might just. You know, I might do the. What do you call those little sporty cameras that the kids play
like
with
these GoPro.
Days? Yeah, the GoPro. I'm gonna GoPro my snow blowing.
I love it.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché. Touché. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's time for Touché. Chris Roebling is in the house.
Hi there.
And in for Dave Lundy tonight, Kitty Kurth. Kitty, good to see you.
Good evening, everybody.
All right.
We miss Dave, but we love seeing you.
That's right. That's right. There you go. Good start. Let's get right to it tonight. Lots to talk about. I think we start with healthcare. I like to call it Trump care. It's just too good. It's too good. Chris, what do you think of it? I mean, do you think that today the Congressional Budget Office coming out with its estimates of what do you think, how many people are going to be uninsured? Does this hurt Donald Trump and the move for a Republican healthcare system?
No, I think it actually helps. I think that the party will come together. I think that this is the one chance. I think it's a very complicated situation. But I also think that the report, I think that the report was not as bad as people are saying. Kitty might be saying it's bad, but I don't think the report was nearly as bad as people are saying. And I also am, I'm of the ilk. I believe that the Congressional Budget Office desperately needs to be disbanded. It needs to be wiped out. It is decidedly, very deeply, very openly partisan.
Really?
Absolutely.
I thought it was run by Republicans. I read this whole thing and it's run by Republicans.
That is not true. No, that is not true. That
is
not true. It is not true. And in fact, what you've got, as in so many of the bureaucracies, when the speakership is in the hands of Republicans, eventually the CBO chairmanship or CBO directorship comes up and then you can choose somebody. But it's very, very short, the list of political appointees over there. And everybody below that level is a Democrat. And I'll give you a specific example.
So you believe it's partisan?
When Clinton and Gingrich, those two balanced the budget four times in the 1990s, each time, and I remember reading this as it happened, each time the Congressional Budget Office fought them tooth and nail, and it is a real blight on the record of Paul Ryan that he has not wiped it out.
That I was there in 92. I was running the Concord Coalition, and our job was to get people to tell the government to balance the budget. And we did, and we got it into surplus. But all of the people at the CBO then and now were Republicans. I hired several of them to work at the Concord Coalition, and they did a great job. Right. They were numbers people.
Here's a second example. When they scored Obamacare in 9-10, right? Obamacare started in 9 and it was passed in 10. And when they scored the final version in the spring of 10, the consultant hired by the CBO was not independent, was not nonpartisan, was not somebody who thought for himself. It was one of the chief architects of Obamacare. And that is why CBO got the original estimate of how many people would be covered by today.
100%. All right, back to Kitty.
What we're
back
talking
to
about is
they
now.
Said it would be 25
we're
million, and it's 13
when
million.
Paul Ryan's been running the
cannot,
House and been hiring
right,
everybody for
right.
the House. How? Why? If he hasn't put his own people in there, what the heck is wrong with him? He's been in charge of the House for long enough
Many of
that
us
he should have hired
that.
People.
Many of us
so,
have been asking.
What I thought we were going to talk about today, though, was health care, not paying for health care. Because if we really cared about health care in this country, Trump would not have put a ban on qualified doctors trying to come back into the United States to go to their jobs. He wouldn't have put a ban on medical students who are trained to come here and be our doctors. We have a huge doctor shortage. We have a huge healthcare shortage. If we were really talking about healthcare, we would get rid of this funding model, go with a completely different model, and worry about getting people doctors, not about
let me ask you that, Chris. Let me ask you, because the assessment and the interpretation and the pieces this weekend really centered around the idea that there were three pillars that the Obamacare kind of rested on, this idea of pre-existing conditions. Another was down the line. But the 26-year-old and
the portability.
Right.
The portability.
The idea being that right. a lot of conservative Republicans will say this new plan is a watered-down version because it doesn't change those pillars. It just messes around and weakens it entirely.
No, that's they're saying it's a Obamacare light because it does not attack the funding directly. Okay, they say it is Obamacare light because it, in essence, through the refundable tax credits, which are tax credits that go to people of lesser means, it is maintaining the entitlement. Now, that's what
it's a fancy word.
I'm
for
not
subsidies.
One of those.
Right, right.
I'm not one of those people, but that's what they are saying. Right. We owe it to them to try and get their complaint straight.
Which entitlement?
No, but
I'm just asking for clarification. I'm not arguing.
No,
which entitlement does it?
The entitlement for the low income people who are now some getting into Obamacare and mostly getting over into Medicaid.
Okay.
All right. So let me ask you, Kitty. I'm, people have come out and said, okay, this is really what you're taking is a health care plan that we had in the Affordable Health Care Act, and you are dumbing it down. You're watering it down. The same things that were going to be there are not there anymore. The provisions and the securities are not there. There's trouble on the horizon. The CBO says it. Does all this mean chaos?
Well, it means that we aren't really fixing it. And granted, Obamacare was a step in the right direction, but there were plenty of things wrong with it. But I mean, if it were me, I would say we should fund healthcare in a totally different way. And that's maybe another show. But, you know, the problem is it doesn't really fix what needs to be fixed in our system. Way back when, since Chris brought up the 90s, I'm going to go there again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, way back when Paul Tsongas and Mike Dukakis and a lot of Republicans, including, I believe, Bob Dole, were talking about a managed healthcare system where you would have statewide buying pools so that all of the small businesses and individuals could could get into one group. So essentially the buying pool could be a large group and they could negotiate better prices. And quite honestly, I think that would have been a much smarter incremental way for us to move rather than from Obamacare the way it was. Because like I am a small business person, but the way Obamacare is set up and I think the way Trump Care is going to be set up, I don't have enough employees that I can buy in the small business market.
Well,
I have to buy as an individual.
There's actually a change in Trump Care, which will enable small business people, of whom I am also one, to join associations to get the benefit of a buying pool. But I think Kitty's
great.
Making... Yeah,
which would be great. Chris, don't cut me off. I'm agreeing with you.
I know. I think that Kitty is making an important point, which is especially important for the Republicans who are complaining about the Ryan plan. And that is, we did not get here overnight. We will not get out of here overnight. And there isn't, given the shift in, or the progress of healthcare legislation since World War II, which is when we decided to give employers a tax break that self-employed people would not realize until now, Trump Care. You've got a tilting of the playing field with respect to the delivery of healthcare in this country. That's another whole story, like Kitty was just saying.
Yeah, that's topic for another day.
Yeah, I agree, but I feel like the talking points are the same.
So
I feel like in 2010,
here's the problem.
Feel like, hold on, in 2010, I feel like I heard the same thing from the Democrats saying this is going to be finally a chance for you to work freelance and do things outside. You don't have to work at all. Now I hear Republicans saying the same thing.
But it's not. Like, it's going backwards. There will be fewer people that have health insurance, which will mean, ironically, that health care costs are going to go up. Because if I don't have health insurance next week and I get sick, well, probably not me because I don't go to the doctor. But, you know, if somebody gets their leg broken, they'll end up in the emergency room. Leg broken, bad example. If somebody gets sick and they go to the emergency room, it's
going to
cost
right.
more than if they had a doctor and went to their physician.
All right, let's take a quick break. I want to stay on time here. Chris Roebling, Kitty Kurth in studio tonight. We're doing Touche.
Touche.
We'll come back. We'll continue, but we'll also talk about wiretaps, district attorneys. See, you guys name it. We'll talk about it. It's Touche here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. Chris Roebling, Kitty Kurth in studio. We're talking healthcare, and we'll talk a little wiretapping a little bit later. Let's stay on the healthcare stuff. Chris, let me get to you. You know, as we talk about this story and it continues to be the front pager, especially after today, the CBO coming out, you know, there's you said just at the beginning, this isn't going to affect the parties, but does it at all affect the votes? Meaning, you know, the Republicans own the majority in both the House and Senate. Is this an easy ride, or are we going to have sort of a...
Well, here is the part of the scoring that didn't get reported very widely, and that is... Obamacare is in fact imploding, and Obamacare is a disaster.
It's questionable.
And
that is a. I just fact checked you.
If you have insurance, and you didn't used to have insurance,
no, I'm just saying. Like I've heard that, but I've heard plenty of people say it's not.
Yeah.
So I mean, I checked you on that.
On its well, then okay. Trump should be heard because
sure.
Trump says we should not touch it until next year because it will implode on itself, and it is. Justin, with all respect to the people you've been listening to. It is imploding, and it will not. It is not a sustainable system. Now, let's not argue. That's my position. Other people think okay, but here, I think that we are at a point with the Republicans where the very conservative Republicans and the doctrinal or ideological Republicans are saying this is a bad idea because it hasn't attacked. The entitlement.
Yeah, it's not okay. What we signed up for.
Are now, these the people we're calling the Freedom Caucus?
Right. Yeah. Some themselves. Of the Freedom Caucus people, plus Senator Tom Cotton, said, do not get stuck walking the plank for this bill that cannot pass in its current form in the United States Senate. I believe that the part of this scoring that has not received attention is the budget office, which I believe is horribly partisan, actually said... These elements will stabilize the insurance
okay.
market. And that is something of extreme significance. And I think behind that, you get Republicans coming in. Why? Because the another two phases in the Republican plan are the Secretary of HHS making the 1,400 changes that he is empowered to make by the Obamacare bill. And number three is the final catch-up of changes where they'll address the issue of medical liability, et cetera.
I want to go to Chris's point about Obamacare imploding and Trump saying, like, people have fewer choices. Let's be clear. People have fewer choices in the insurance marketplace because insurance companies are pulling out because they can't make the crazy profit margins that they're demanding to make. In Illinois, we had several choices. Obama didn't tell them you can't be part of the choice. They took the insurance companies themselves took themselves out of the market because they felt like they weren't making a big enough profit.
Well,
you know, maybe the government needs to say this is where your profits are capped. You can make this much and your profits are capped. That's what a lot of the Medicare delivery is. And that's why Medicare works. When you are caring for an older parent and you go to the hospital, they will always want to take your Medicare insurance first before the private insurance because they like working with Medicare. So maybe we could look at expanding Medicare.
Chris?
If that's what the industry likes.
There's something to be said about
here's what I'm going to say about it. Kitty is pointing up the fact that Democrats have absolutely no plan whatsoever to save Obamacare. There is no Democrat alternative. They have decided not to participate. They created it.
Well,
they
come on.
Rammed
they're not
it
in
down
power.
They were asking for the Republican plan when the Republicans were in the minority in the United States House of Representatives. The Democrats were in the majority, and they didn't even have one bill.
No, but they
and
just
they created
had, they,
it.
They created
sorry,
a historical
they created
it's called
it.
Obamacare.
No.
We have a plan.
Well, that plan is imploding to all
you
but the most
so,
liberal
but most
and most
people don't.
Partisan
How is it
eyes.
Imploding? How is it imploding?
Well, I want to say, hold
what
on. When you say,
of it
hold
is
on.
Imploding?
Kitty, when you say most people don't. This is the only entitlement in our history as a country that has failed to generate a majority of support 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, 7 years after it was
passed. More than 50%, 54% of people this week like Obamacare. The last time I checked, 54% was a majority, Chris.
I'm sorry. What you passed in 10.
Chris does different math. He doesn't do
it's funny.
He uses the metric system.
What you know, so you have 1 week in your favor, which I haven't seen. I'm taking your word for it. You have 1 week in your favor. We beat the Democrats in 2010 because of this, in 2012. You lost the House. You lost the Senate. You lost the White House. And you think this is a popular program.
Yes. And now the people who have it, who said, oh, I don't want Obamacare. I want ACA health care, because they were too enraptured by the Republican rhetoric to know that ACA and Obamacare is the same thing. Now that they have it, they want it to go away.
Here's
like
Kitty's
every
idea.
Other entitlement in
Kitty's,
our
Kitty's
history.
Idea
2 minutes,
is that
guys.
In five states,
ding.
In five states, we have one provider, one only.
That's okay? Not my idea.
In 1,000 counties of America, we have one provider, and already we know from not Republican sources, but from Obamacare sources, that the average of 25% increases this year, some triple right. digit, but an average of 25% increases in the premiums this year is going to be exceeded in the 2018.
I read
round.
About that.
Chris, you are absolutely right. Chris is absolutely right. We have one provider.
That's
we have one provider
failure.
In those counties. And you know why it failed? Because the insurance companies, let me finish. In those counties, it failed because the insurance companies have refused to participate. It has nothing to do with the law. Let me finish. I let you finish, Chris. Hold your horses. Because nevertheless, I will persist. Those counties failed because the insurance companies didn't want to do business there. Nothing about the new plan is going to make those insurance companies want
That's
to do
a great
business
point.
There.
There is. What makes Blue Cross Blue Shield
it
do
is not
more? Right?
President Obama. It is not the Congress that is raising the cost of premiums. It is the insurance companies.
I'm sorry.
Chris Roebling, last point.
The cost of premiums has been increased by the attempt of the Democrats, who were then in power, to defy economic gravity.
Chris,
when
before Obamacare, my insurance premiums went up than they do now.
When you say we have this much healthcare delivery system and you increase the people going into it like this, the result is going to be higher prices. Everybody understood that. And the liberals supported this because they wanted it to crash so that they could replace it with single payer. It was part of the plan at the time.
Or because we think that we should be increasing the number of doctors and increasing the number of kids who have access to medical school and who are going to medical school and make college affordable.
That's why Trump wants highly skilled immigrants to come to the United States.
And that's why he put the Muslim ban so they can't get in.
That's not how we end, Chris. Chris Roebling, Kitty Kirth in studio. Chris, you got an event at the Union Club on Wednesday, right?
Please come to the Union League Club. It's a joint event with the Jewish United Fund of Chicago. We've got a Jewish rabbi and a Muslim imam talking about the similarities in their traditions. And it's the kind of conversation.
And I'll be there, Chris, I promise.
I hope that you're going to be there and bring Kevin.
Chris Roebling, Kitty Kirth, great touche. Thanks for being here. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Thank you, Rob. All right, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Tim Baltz is going to join us. Tim, a big-time Second City actor, went out to Los Angeles, got his own show, his TV show on CISO. It's called Shrink. It debuts this week. And he'll be back in studio. Good. Great to have Tim Baltz back in Chicago, even for just a week. But it's great to have him in studio tonight. Tim's great. He's hilarious. He was on Second City main stage for a while, and he is now making his name in Hollywood. He'll be coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, we'll talk about my good friend Amy Krauss Rosenthal, who died today. That's a big story. Her Steve Bertrand had it in the newscast, and that was a big story. You may know Amy from she did the Modern Love column where she talked about, does anyone want to? She did a dating profile for her husband because she was dying of cancer, and she succumbed today at the age of 51. So we'll talk about Amy's legacy. I'll play a little bit of audio that we've produced over the years together. And also coming up at Studio 435 tonight, the Walters Indie Rock Band live in studio here on Michigan Avenue. So we got a big show coming up tonight. Well, yesterday, the Northwestern Wildcats brought a little light back to the Chicago area by making the NCAA tournament. It's been a few years since Chicago's was represented, but don't tell the women that. The DePaul Blue Demons women's basketball program is no stranger to March Madness. Last year, the team went to the Sweet 16, got beat by Oregon State. And this year, earlier tonight, it was announced that they are back in the tournament as a 7 seed after winning the Big East and making it to the Big East Tournament Championship game. Doug Bruno's the head coach. He's been the head coach on and off since 1976. And in the last 15 years, he has taken the Blue Demons to the NCAA tournament every year. Bruno was an assistant coach for the Olympic women's basketball team, which won gold in 2012. And he is my guest at the big table tonight. Coach Bruno, good to see you.
Great to be back, Justin. Thanks for
congratulations having us. On the 7 seed. I the first thing I said when I grabbed you out of the green room was, is there controversy over Big East regular season champion being a 7 seed in the tournament?
Now, Justin, our job is to play. The beauty of this NCAA tournament, men and women, there's 3 great events in America, sporting events, not counting NASCAR, not counting the Kentucky Derby, but team sports. You have the Super Bowl, and that's a one-week, one-and-out. It's a once-a-week, one-and-out event. The World Series has got its own drama to it with games coming every day and every other day. Yeah. And then the March Madness is 3 weeks of 63 ball games that the fans, all the media love to get excited about who got seated where, who's going where, who's playing who hypothetically didn't get a good draw, who got a great draw. But when you're a coach and you're a player, it's about focusing
on one
team.
How do you focus? How do you not?
Focus on one team. You have to focus on one team. We're playing Northern Iowa, the 10th seed, and that's all we can think about. Down in Starkville, Mississippi, because the women's tournament is still hosted by the top 16 seeds, 1, 2, 3, 4 in each region get to host the first 2 rounds. So Mississippi State is the 2 seed. They're going to play their 15 seed, Troy State, and then we're the 7 playing the 10 down in Starkville. Four teams will be there.
It's hard. I mean, I think that if there's anyone who could get excited about the controversy over seeding, it would be the coach or the AD. I mean, how do you, beyond keeping your kids focused, and beyond the fact that, keeping the eye on basketball, how do you, as a coach who's been doing this for so many years, how do you keep focused when it comes to controversy over where you're playing, when you're playing, things like that?
Just the way you're asking the question, Justin, is just exactly what we have to do. It's focus. You have to keep your players focused. I have to focus. Anger only makes a bad situation worse. So you got to just get control of yourself and just stay focused on the task at hand. And that's Northern Iowa. This is a very good Northern Iowa team from the Missouri Valley Conference. Drake in the Missouri Valley Conference also is going to the NCAA tournament. He's won 22 straight. Northern Iowa's only lost to Drake. They've lost to Drake 3 times. So it's going to be a really tough first ball game.
What's the strength of your team this year? Last year we went over to Pequod's and we talked about, what the team existed of in 2016. As you think about 2017, what's the core of the women's basketball program at DePaul?
Well, it's a very unique season because Jessica January, the preseason player of the year in the Big East, went down with a broken finger the first game of the Big East season. So senior Brooke Schulte stepped up and became the Big East player of the year. In Jessica's absence, Jackie Grant became the Big East Defensive Player of the Year and a first-team All-Big East. And then Tanita Allen became the 6th Player of the Year. Kelly Campbell was on the All-Freshman team. So these players all stepped up. Amara Coleman, we really had to step up. We lost three starters this year. Marte Grays went down before the season started. One of our 6'2 inside players, Ashton Millendor, our second-leading scorer, best 3-point shooter, went down. I didn't think we could survive either of those two. And then Jessica January went down. So I just think the blood and guts of the ball club every single day, people like Lauren Prochaska, Amara Coleman, Kelly Campbell, Shante Stonewall, those guys just stepping up and not making any excuses.
That really, a lot we hear about sports is overcoming adversity. When you are at the helm of a squad that loses that many players, loses 3 starters going into the season, What's the message that you send to the people who are up next? The kids who may, this may be the first time they're seeing the bright lights, on campus, where their name's getting called to start in the lineup.
There's a couple places you go. I mean, first of all, you have to have great empathy for the injured players. There's nothing worse in sport than to see an athlete injured in all sports. It's just really, it's the one negative aspect of sports is our injuries. And you have to have empathy for the injured players. You can't have sympathy for them. And then you have to challenge the second component is challenging your players just to be – the word step up is used as a cliche almost by coaches and again, media and fans. But also, players don't have to understand that stepping up is nothing more than being what you are, being the best of what you are. Don't try to be something else. Be the best of what you are. And if you can get your players to focus on just being the best of what they are – And just then that's really what stepping up is all about. Don't make any excuses. Nobody's going to care. Just back to the question about the seating. Nobody cares that we're a 7 or a 10. Once the games start, people are only going to be interested in the drama that's created by 2 hours of great basketball.
DePaul's the 7th seed in the women's NCAA tournament. They're going to play on Friday down in Mississippi. All right, Coach Bruno's my guest at the big table. We'll take a quick break right now. We'll come back. We'll talk more about women's basketball here in Chicago. I mean, it's amazing to think this is your 15th straight year in the NCAA tournament. When we think about the men's side, I mean, I just kind of referenced. I mean, that thing's been 3 or 4 years since we had a team from the area that even made the tournament. So it's not a given to have DePaul going 15 years straight is saying something. Coach Bruno's in studio. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. In studio with me tonight at the big table, Coach Doug Bruno. He is the coach of the women's DePaul basketball team that is going to their 15th straight NCAA tournament. Selection show was today, about 2 hours ago, in which the Blue Demons found out they're the 7th seed. They got to go to Mississippi State's home court, because Mississippi State is the 2 seed, and that's how they do the women's tournament. There's home field advantage or home court advantage. You know, I'm interested because you talked a little bit, Coach, before the break about, you know, motivating your players or really trying to get the best performance out of them, but keep them inside of themselves. You know, there's a lot of philosophy that goes into basketball. There's a lot of, you know, sort of understanding how you overcome adversity, how you deal with when your body can't go as far as you think you can, and or are mental blocks. I mean, there's a lot to this game that the casual fan doesn't think about.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, it is a mental game, and it's physical, but it's also very much mental, and the two are very much connected. You have to have great physical fitness, but you have to have great strength of mind. And, you know, we talk about the mental discipline and you know, overcoming adversity is really just having the mental toughness to take anything that comes your way that's not just perfect. Anything that's negative that comes your way during a game. It might be a referee's call. It might be the coach talking to you in a tone you didn't like. It might be the fans throwing pennies at you. You know, it might be your opponent grabbing you, spitting on you, biting you. I mean, there's all kinds of different little things that can happen during a game. And there's things that can happen leading up to a game to teach these athletes to be able to compartmentalize, study hard all day. We've also been ranked in the top 25 academically. I'm really proud of this group. Over the last 8 years, we're one of the only schools in the country to go to the NCAA tournament and be top 25 ranked both in basketball and academically. So these players, we're in final exams right now, and our players, you know, we've got players in
you're in final exams right now.
Final exams right now.
They can't work that out, that there's a tournament that you have to do plus there's final exams.
The big picture to Paul is we have a great system, a great quarter system, and we're coming down the stretch of our second quarter. We'll be taking exams on Wednesday and then get on a plane for Starkville.
How do you teach to an 18-year-old woman mental toughness? I mean, what is it that – I mean, how can you instill that? I mean, do you kind of have to be born with that, the idea that you put – talk about how you get mental toughness out of your players.
Well, I think, first of all, it starts at home. I think, you know, children – are still raised by great parents today. And you know, there's a lot of, I hate the label. I hate the label millennial. I hate the label. I hate all labels, actually. And I'm just really – you know, but by the time you're 3 to 5 years old, you're pretty well defined. Your character starts to become pretty well defined just by your birth order, your brothers or siblings or sisters that are maybe pounding mm-hmm. you for that little toy, or your mom and dad. I started teaching at a very, very young age. So, I mean, I think mental toughness is still something that comes – from home. But then I think it's developed through the years, through the different aspects of school, the different aspects of sports through the year. And really, the ability to look adversity in the face and just fight it off.
Yeah, but you got it. I mean, when you're at the level that the women are at playing at DePaul, I mean, it's different than me trying to face adversity that's a little, it's snowing and I'm not sure how I'm going to get from Michigan Avenue to Wabash. You know what I mean? Like, yes, I have mental adversity in my life, but the kind that goes into playing professional or in this case college, but possibly professional sports is, I mean, that's another level. I mean, it takes training.
There's no question that these athletes, I mean, they work very, very hard and they work very hard academically. They work very hard in their sport and they work so much harder than people ever see. You know, they're on the floor in front of the public 35 to 40 times a year. And so that's what the public sees. They have no idea about the amount of time that the athlete spends in the lonely gym of summer, the lonely gym when nobody's watching, when nobody's cheering, you know, when it's hot. And, you know, just the willingness to get in that gym and work to make yourself better. That's what goes into being an athlete. And then caring about your academic, having academic motivation. And you know, we ask our players, my goal as a coach is to provide three areas of opportunity for our athletes. I mean, you know, after family, after God, family, you know, then you're talking about these three areas being their academic life at DePaul. DePaul's a great academic institution. But if I don't ask my players to maximize, the only way I can pay these athletes is in the form of education. So if I don't ask them to maximize their education, if I don't make them accountable for maximizing their education, I'm using them. And I think any collegiate coach is using their players if they don't make their players accountable for their academic work and working to their potential academically.
Do you go ahead.
Second part of their day is the athletic part of their day, which is, you know, that includes more than just basketball. It includes weightlifting. It includes, there's just a strength and conditioning. There's all kinds of different aspects to that. And then the third part that I care about my kids having every day is I want them to have a life. I want them to have a life as students, as regular students. I don't want my players thinking in basketball 24/7. I want them really to have an academic side of themselves and a personal side of themselves. They're 18 to 23 year old young women. I want them to enjoy college also.
Coach, I'm interested in that because I never really heard the idea of a coach wanting to maximize education, that being the payment. I mean, that really is the payment as we swirl around the controversies of whether or not we should pay student athletes. The payment in this situation is that you're getting a free education or a discounted education and you want to get the most out of it. Do you feel enough coaches in your position in other Division I areas, maybe on the men's side, football? Did they lose sight of that? I mean, do you feel like that's a shared sort of ethos when it comes to coaching student athletes in college?
I think it's really becoming so. I think in the not that far distant past, you know, coaches probably didn't really care that much about how their students performed academically. But I think the NCAA has done a really, really good job of getting educating coaches on at all levels, men's and women's, about the importance of these athletes walking away not just with a degree, but actually being educated while they're earning their degrees. I just think you're seeing a step up in football and in men's basketball. You know, I think I saw something today academically that the men's graduation rate in men's basketball now might be up to 82% from maybe 56% 10 years ago. And I'm throwing those figures out off of a quick read from an NCAA article today. But, you know, they are definitely making a concerted effort for our athletes to become educated while they're earning quality degrees.
Well, I mean, I saw a piece last night, I think it was on ESPN on SportsCenter. It was the feature piece on the kid from UCLA, Ball, who's going to the tournament, and his family. So he's got two brothers that are in high school that are already going to be recruited. But they talked about, they were not shy about saying one and done. We need to get prepared and ready to play in the NBA as quick as possible. That's where the money's at. We're at UCLA, we're playing one and done. You know, when you hear that kind of stuff, and I was actually refreshing to hear it from the father, because it wasn't sort of like they were pretending like they were going to college to get their education, then deciding to go to the NBA. No, they were upfront about it. I mean, do those kind of things, it's probably not as prevalent on the women's side, but I would think that women, you know, if they have the talent and they want to go to the WNBA, they might split a little bit early. does that get in the way of the concept of what you're talking about? Coaches really pushing towards maximizing education and graduation rates?
Well, you have to give any human being in America the opportunity to go earn a living at what they're good at. And so, you know, Frank Sinatra never regretted not going to college. He went and did what he did well. And you know, Bobby Simmons from DePaul University is a great DePaul story of a young man that came to DePaul and left early and came back and earned his degree. I mean, just because they're leaving early and maximizing their basketball potential by being good enough to play in the NBA as young as 1 year and out, doesn't mean that they're not going to go back to school later, right. and really value what the college education can do for them.
Coach Doug Bruno in studio with me tonight. He's my guest at the big table. The women's DePaul basketball team, the Blue Demons, just announced tonight. They're the seventh seed in the NCAA tournament. They're playing Northern Iowa in Mississippi. And where was it at?
Starkville.
Sorry, I didn't remember that.
Mississippi State.
Let's take a break, and then we'll get an update on tonight's news, and we'll have more with Coach Bruno here at the big table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio at the big table tonight, Coach Doug Bruno. The women's DePaul Blue Demons team gets the seventh seed in the NCAA tournament. Northern Iowa will be their first opponent, the 10th seed. You know, I will speak for Coach Bruno. Seven's way too low for the way too high. Did you say high or low? I guess low for the Blue Demon team that won the Big East championship, the regular season championship, went to the championship game, and you get a seven. All right, I know you don't want to get into politics.
We got to lace them up and play, Justin.
Let's talk about college basketball, especially on the women's side, has seen in the last 10 years, I would say, you've seen more and more coverage of it from major sports outlets like ESPN, mostly because of Connecticut's unbelievable run. When you're winning 100 games in a row, they're getting the highlight. They're the number one highlight. They're beating baseball games or LeBron James or whatever it is. They're the team. Everyone wants to cover that. And then, you know, because of the trickle down, and I'm a fan who's a casual fan in the trickle down, I start watching more. I know about the Baylor team. I know about the South Carolina team. These are big, almost basketball factories. As a coach in Chicago, how do you keep up with recruiting when you have these basketball programs that are getting such notoriety that they're getting top billing, and anyone who's good that comes out of Chicago has the option to go play at those places?
Well, Justin, first of all, the you can look at the UConn dominance as negative or positive, and I choose to look at it as positive because I just believe it's our jobs to ascend up to the standards set by UConn versus whining about how good they are and expecting them to come down to us. I don't think that's the way it should be. I think we should go get players and be as competitive. I love to compete, so it's a great standard. Coach Oriam is a friend of mine. We coached together with the Olympics, and it's I respect what they do. And basically, he's really simple in his recruiting. He's able to sell championships. We're one of only six schools in the country that have been to 14 straight, now 15 straight NCAA tournaments. So short of winning a national championship, we're in some pretty select company already. Yeah. Just by our body of work over time. So I think that's something really that is sellable. We've got a great institution. I've got a great staff. Our players are just great people, but how do you know, when it comes to recruiting, I think the biggest resource, I think, you know, people talk about resources in recruiting, and I love to make this comparison all the time. People think recruiting resources or facilities are a football stadium that seats 100,000 people. Think about a football stadium that seats 100,000 people. Let's just take the Horseshoe down at Ohio State. Yeah. 100,000 people. It's filled six times a year. It's empty most of the rest of the year. All right, we've got a facility called Sweet Home Chicago that doesn't go to sleep. It's
you're selling the town,
it's,
right?
It's awake right. every minute of every single day. There's a reason why every kid that chooses a Big Ten school comes back to Lincoln Park to have fun at their first Christmas break after their first six football games, the entire Big Ten is in Lincoln Park in DePaul's backyard. They come back because it's a better place mm-hmm. to be. They're here all summertime.
So you sell the idea that Chicago is...
And we have a great institution. DePaul University, you know, the facility, rather than having a 100,000-seat football stadium, we've got tremendous professors. We've got small class sizes. Our student-athletes, 17 to 25 people in a classroom. You know, most of these state schools are your 200, 300, 400, 500 kids in a classroom. You know, and we have professors that are both researchers and they actually teach. Our student athletes aren't taught by grad assistants. They're taught by teachers.
Beyond what I know from football movies or basketball recruiting movies, I mean, I guess when you're recruiting a kid, when you're recruiting a 17-year-old girl who's coming out of a high school and you want her to come to DePaul, I mean, the sell is Chicago, the sell is DePaul basketball, the sell is, like you just mentioned, class sizes. Is the sell to the parents or to the kid?
I think it's a combination of both. I think every parent means it when they tell you, and every parent tells you, it's going to be Justin's decision. You know, your mom and dad, we're recruiting Justin, it's Justin's decision.
Right.
That's what they tell you. And they believe it. But that doesn't mean they're not quietly doing everything they possibly can to influence. And I've had some parents tell me, it's their decision. Unless I see them making a wrong decision, then I'm going to make sure they make a right decision. So what are they really telling you?
Right?
Yeah. So at any rate, you know, I think it's important that we recruit both the player and the parent. I love recruiting a parent. Parents and their players. You know, these are the people making the decision. It's their lives. These are the people that we really, really want to recruit.
Right. You know, there's been a lot of talk on the men's side when it comes to college basketball about DePaul and its place, because you're in the Big East and you've had a great run. You won the Big East regular season and, you know, went to the championship game. The men's side has not had the same success. They've been at the bottom this year, 9-9. I think it was 9-23. Terrible in the Big East tournament. Bounced in the first round, and 7 of the 10 teams from that league went to the tournament. It is high stakes, high competition when you're talking about teams like Villanova, and Creighton, and other places like that. There's been this argument in town about whether or not DePaul should rethink its platform and instead of being in the Big East, be in a Conference USA, be in a mid-major. What do you think about that? What do you think about the idea of where DePaul is in the Big East and its success?
I, first of all, I love Dave Lato and his staff. Dave Lato has done a great job of coaching our young men. And right now, you know, he's having to build this thing from the ground up. But Dave and his staff are just, first of all, I believe we should be in the Big East. I believe we absolutely should be in the Big East. This, you know, this institution, you know, I am old enough to have remembered, you know, every time that we've built a new building, Alumni Hall, the Allstate, Rosemont, Wintrust Arena is coming online next year down 2200 South.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to just be a great boost for Dave's recruiting. At the same time, I think Dave Lato he's a genuine good man that teaches values as well as basketball. And he's a really, really quality basketball coach. But he'll remind you, if he was sitting here, you know, he was at UConn as an assistant coach
right.
when they had nothing going. And to turn a program, it seems like it's so hard. It's not easy. Don't misunderstand this. But it seems like it's a monumental climb, and it's really a couple players. It's really, you know, and we all love the players we have presently in our program. Billy Garrett Jr. has just graduated as a scholar athlete of the Big East and has had a great career here. So Dave is out there with the staff right now working to get they're better players. I think it was Bum Phillips, the football coach, said there's two ways to build a football program. Get better players or get the players you got better. I think Dave does a great job of getting his players better, and I know he's going to do a great job of getting better players because he's been here before and done it.
Yeah.
You know, his first time here, we went to the NCAA.
It was the last time, right?
Right. in 2003. And so Dave knows what he's doing, and we just have to get a couple players to get this ball rolling, get this thing started. You know, he talks about the fact that Jay Wright was at Hofstra and he was at Northeastern as a head coach one time. They both won four games one year. So everybody starts from the bottom. But no way do I think we belong anywhere but the Big East, especially the way the Big East is configured now with five really quality teams on the East Coast and then five really quality teams right here in the Midwest.
Coach Doug Bruno is my guest at the big table. He's the coach of the women's basketball team at DePaul University, the DePaul Blue Demons. They are going to the tournament, seventh seed. They had their celebration today, and then he came over here in studio, so I appreciate you coming down. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up the conversation at the big table here with Coach Bruno. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest at the big table, Coach Doug Bruno. 15 straight NCAA tournament appearances for the women's program at DePaul. The DePaul Blue Demons are the seventh seed. They're playing the 10 seed Northern Iowa. What's their mascot? What's their name?
You know, just
I don't even know.
I think they're the Panthers, but I'm not positive. I'm guessing on that one. I'm guessing on that one. I know they're purple and gold.
Well, they're going to be down in Mississippi. They're playing on Mississippi State's home court, as the rules of the NCAA tournament on the women's side. That's coming up on Friday at noon. The DePaul Blue Demons. I mean, you've been coaching on and off at good old Lincoln Park since 1976. I mean, you're talking about 40 years here. So talk about your experience. I mean. This has been quite a career for you, coaching women's basketball in Chicago.
Well, I just love coaching the game of basketball, but I really love coaching the people that play the game, whether they're men or women. I mean, I had that good experience at Loyola Chicago under Gene Sullivan. We went to a Sweet 16 in 1985, so that was very there's three people. Coach Ray Meyer gave me my start by giving me a scholarship to play at DePaul. Without Coach Ray, I would have nothing. Frank McGrath was his assistant, and then Coach Sullivan helped me into the profession by letting me be his associate head coach at Loyola. So, we've had a great experience. Back in the mid-70s when we started the program, Jeannie Lenti-Ponsetto was my captain, and today she's the athletic director at DePaul, and Jeannie's one of the best captains, if not the best captain I've ever had.
She's now your boss.
And she's my best captain. She knows I'd tell her that even if she wasn't my boss. Yeah, so I've been blessed to be able to work at one's alma mater at DePaul and watch all the changes in Lincoln Park from when my parents dropped me off to play there in 1968 and see the gentrification of the neighborhood, see the whole north side change and grow. And Father Dennis Holtschneider has just been a great president for us. He's going to be leaving us in June, but he's been a magnificent president for us. And he had the vision together with Mayor Emanuel to put together the Wind Trust Project, which is now called the Wind Trust Project. Right. Chicago is just an absolutely great convention city. And the only thing it didn't have was a good mid-size arena. And the city was going to build this, whether DePaul was involved or not.
Well, I mean,
they needed this arena.
That arena has a lot of non-sports headlines attached to it. I mean, a lot of stories about just whether or not we should be building a stadium right now, with the budget situation, we use that money for something else. Are you surprised by that? I mean, DePaul's name gets kind of dragged through it, but...
Well, DePaul, if the mayor was sitting here with you right now, he'd be telling you that the DePaul is helping the city of Chicago. We're paying for half of the building of the building, and we're also not owning the building. The city owns the building. We'll rent from the city. So it's something that it's a partnership that just is going to be over. In the big picture, it's going to be very, very good for the city of Chicago because it's going to increase our convention business. It's going to create the hotels being built down there. The vision for the McCormick Square area right now to be able to have a place for the conventioners to stay. The new Marriott's going up. There's a Hilton going up. There's already the Hyatt there. This is just going to have a great economic impact on the city of Chicago, and ultimately is going to provide more income for the city of Chicago, so there'll be more income to go around for the schools.
With all the excitement around the Northwestern Wildcats, we see in the tournament here, and also the names that you threw out who gave you your start and talking about DePaul basketball and being involved in the program, even going dating back to the 70s and 80s, talk about that. Talk about, because DePaul used to be And on the men's side, just sort of like Chicago basketball. Everybody knew it as Chicago basketball. It's faded from time. Do you think you can reclaim that title at some point? Do you believe that DePaul Blue Demons basketball can retain that special place in the heart of Chicagoans near and wide?
Absolutely. I mean, Chicago loves a winner. Chicago has shown that they really do love DePaul, and the great people at Allstate have been so good to us out there for so many years. But at the same time, you know, bringing this program back downtown, I think, is going to have a great impact on Dave's ability to recruit. And I just think it's a couple players away, and I've seen other programs turn this thing with the recruitment of a couple key players.
Okay. So let's get right to the mindset and the mental agility that you need to play in a tournament game. So on Friday, your team is going to be in Mississippi getting ready for a matchup with Northern Iowa. You mentioned it at the top about focus, and we can get into that and all that. But what – I mean, I would imagine that the heartbeat is faster, that the present – everything about it, the way that the tournament plays and turns those gyms over, you know, from court to court is different. How do you relate to and how do you connect with your student-athlete who is – maybe playing the first or second time ever in these kind of circumstances?
Well, we actually start talking about it early in the season and start talking about what the formula is to succeed in the NCAA tournament. And that is basically you're trying to win every single possession. You're trying to win one possession. You're trying to not to overly concern yourself about the score. I like my players to have execution. A great athlete has anxiety before a game. Mm-hmm. But I want my players to have execution anxiety, not result anxiety. If they can have anxiousness that they're going to do the best, you know, just make the maximum effort and do the right, you know, pay attention to the
control. Even if you're down 15 points, the point of being, and especially in your system, is execute the play that's in front of you.
Yeah, pay attention to the details. Pay attention to the details every single trip up and down the floor and just focus on winning each single possession. And if you win those little single possessions, you'd be surprised how at the end of the game, the big score, you take care of the little score with every single possession, and usually at the end of the game, the big score is yours.
Dropping B-ball knowledge here. Coach Doug Bruno, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for being my guest tonight. The women's team, the DePaul Blue Demons, are the seventh seed in the tournament. The NCAA tournament, they're going to be playing on Friday at noon. Coach Bruno, good luck. Now, all of Chicago, we say let's bring that. Let's at least beat Mississippi State on their own court, for the fun of it.
We got to
right?
beat Northern Iowa first, Justin. One in a row twice, Justin. One in a row two times is the objective for the weekend. And I can't tell you thank you enough for having me on and covering women's basketball. We really do appreciate the fact that you're covering women's basketball here in Chicago. So thank you very much.
Coach Bruno, thank you. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in Studio 435 at 10 o'clock. The Walters are here. They're playing Metro coming up. They got a new single out. I'm very excited. These guys sound great. So it'd be great to have them in studio as well tonight. Coming up after 9:30, we'll talk about the life of my friend Amy Cross Rosenthal. Passed away today at the age of 51. Tremendous story. I mean, I can't even wrap my head around the idea that, you know, the story of her passing was in the New York Times because she wrote a column for Modern Love about who wants to date my husband. She was dying of cancer. And the idea that, you know, the New York Times and other places are the ones that break the story that Amy passed away because of that. And how many people, I mean, I was interviewed today by the news. You know, so many people coming through that want to know more about Amy's story, but also just sort of really about that New York Times piece. It's an amazing story, and we'll talk more about Amy coming up after 9:30. Well, a new show will be released this week on CISO. We've talked a lot about the streaming network here, owned by NBC Universal. It's continually produces some of the best comedians and the best television today. And the new show, Shrink, is already getting good buzz, and it debuts on Thursday. Shrink is a show that follows David, a wannabe therapist, on his path to get enough clinical hours to become a real doctor. This means seeing patients for free in his parents' garage. The show is the brainchild of Joliet native Tim Baltz. Baltz was on stage at Second City for years, and he's a familiar face with feature roles in the Christopher Guest movie Mascots and on the Comedy Central show Drunk History. Tim Baltz is here in studio. Welcome back to town, Tim. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you, too, man.
So this is great. I had a chance to watch the first episodes on Amazon.
Yeah, it's free until everything comes out on Thursday.
This is a project that you've been working on for a while. This is something that I mean, we were just talking about in the break, just this idea that, you know, you did the web series for this 6 years ago.
Yeah, 2011, the co-creator and I, Ted Tremper, approached me and he's like, hey, I've got this idea. It's about a guy who graduates from medical school, doesn't match with the residency program. He's $500,000 in debt. He decides to defer his student loans by trying to become a clinical therapist, and he has to get a supervising therapist to sign off on his hours. But when you do that, you can't charge patients for money. So here's the setting. He's doing all these for free in his parents' garage. And I was like, great. Right. And he's like, oh, and we'll get to improvise, and we'll get to pick all the people that we want to improvise with. And we did it, just, you know, we had no ambition about it. I mean, it turns out we kind of did, but we just did it as an experiment to see, will this work as a backdrop for an improvised web series?
That's the beauty of it. You know, in therapy, and you know, the idea of the therapist and the patient, there is a lot of improv tenets in that. There's a lot of listening. There's everything in that, so you can understand why improv works in that setting.
Yeah, it does. And then he had the idea, hey, let's turn this into a full pilot, a 22-minute pilot, and we'll take it to the New York Television Festival in 2012. Which we did, and we ended up winning Best Comedy and Critics Award, and then Gene Demanian Productions kind of came
the
on. The Gene Demanian.
Yeah, right, from SNL, right.
And she's incredible. Gene's in her late 70s, and she's still as fierce as ever, as sharp as ever. She works out every day. She's a force. It's you meet her, and you're just, I don't know, she's got an aura around her. And Patrick Daly, our creative VP, who worked with her, and they said, you know, we want to help you develop this. We want to help you pitch it to TV, which, you know, we were like, we didn't know anything about it. I was still living here. Ted was as well. He went on to be a field producer at Daily Show for a year before leaving that to work on the season that's coming out on Thursday. And we pitched it. We sold it to this TV station called – this TV network called Pivot, which sure doesn't exist anymore. They shut down like 5 months ago.
I think it's we'll get to the end of this story, but the idea that, you know, in 2011 you're starting this project. I mean, you're still in Chicago, you're still at Second City, you're not even sure what your future's going to be, and then now you're in LA, you're working on projects, you're showing up on a lot of different roles and a lot of different great stuff, podcasts, all the stuff, and then boom, you also got this project that you've been working on for five. Why not? Let's try it. Someone's interested.
Yeah. Right? And CISO was great about it. CISO actually had a couple executives, a CEO, and then a person in scripted programming, Evan Shapiro and Kelsey Balance. Kelsey actually from Evanston. And they just loved the story. And they were at Pivot, and they were champions for it. And they said, we really believe in this story. We want it to be made. Pivot had its problems. Obviously not around anymore. But then they ended up at CISO. I did two seasons of a show there called Bajillion Dollar Properties.
Great show, yeah.
And which is great. It's a silly off the wall. It's basically like a mockumentary version of Million Dollar Listing, if you like that show, which I already watched, so I was into it. And I play the office manager who becomes a broker, this real sad sack named Glenn, who he's just a punching bag for everyone.
it's a great character. It's a great show. I mean, a lot of great Chicago talent on that show.
Yeah. And so because of that, they were able to kind of introduce this idea to CISO. I was already known to their audience and to their team there, and they asked us to pitch it. And so we pitched it, and we finally got it back from Pivot. They owned it for like 2.5 years. It sat there. It just sat there. And that's
the Hollywood story.
It is. People told me that, and I thought, well, not me. I moved to LA 3 years ago. You know, I never thought I'd live there. I was Joliet native, lived in Chicago, went to Loyola. Like, I never thought I'd leave. And I show up and I'm like, well, it's not going to happen to me. I just sold something, you know? And it's not that I was rubbing it in anyone's face, but I genuinely thought this won't happen to me. And
I already have something I'm working on. That's why I'm here.
And
right?
bam, it just sat there. It sat there. And luckily, you know, I got to do a couple seasons of Drunk History and Veep and Parks and Rec and a lot of fun stuff. Sirens, which shot here.
How do you, I mean, for you with your background in improv, and you did a lot of stuff at Second City, mm-hmm. how do you get the opportunities to be on a show like Veep or Parks and Rec? I mean, does that help you, the fact that you came from Chicago, that you were part of Second City? Is it all just about connections and relationships? You obviously have to bring the goods.
Yeah.
But the idea that people vouch for you and say, no, Tim's great, we should have Tim?
I think it helps. I mean, Veep was actually the first episode of television that I ever did. And what they do at the beginning of their season is they have a table read. So they sit the full cast down with a couple extra people so that, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus doesn't have to read Clerk number two. And
right.
But it is funny because sometimes they do. Anyway, and then they have all the writers there, and you read the first few episodes of the season. You get the scenes up on their feet. You kind of improvise about it. And somehow my agents got me in there for season three.
Interesting, yeah.
And so I was reading, and Tim Simons, who plays Jonah, he was gone the first few days, so I got to read Jonah. And so I'm just swearing up a storm. Making up whatever comes off
that's
the
awesome.
Top of my head.
Yeah.
And the last day that we were there, I ended up reading the part that I booked. And I left. We finished, and everyone's like, yay, great job. Thank you guys for a very productive week. This was really special. Thank you for joining us. I go to the bathroom, and apparently Julia went up to Armando Iannucci, who was the director and showrunner at the time, and she's like, he's got to play that part, man. And he's like, okay. And that was how I booked my first TV role.
I mean, I've heard a lot of Chicagoans tell that story in the way that they go in, and because of their experiences here in Chicago, because they worked at Second City, someone got them into a room, they're going to read for a small part, but then they improvise and people go, we got to keep this kid. You know, I mean, there is something in the water here when it comes to how you apply yourself to Hollywood situations. That is why people from Chicago seem to do well out there.
Yeah, well, you know, we were talking about this in the break too, but it's a theatrical town, you know. Even the comedy here, the stand-up, the sketch, the improv, it's all kind of influenced by the great theatrical traditions that we have at Steppenwolf, at Goodman. And because of that, like, you take a certain pride in everything, and there is a patience to the process of creating it. And that's not to say that that isn't true in other cities, in other theaters. But Second City, I.O., The Annoyance, they all create, and whatever's in the water, they all create a sense of pride and quality. And when you show up, like, people are... They're, you know, in any industry, people are hungry for people that have pride and patience in the process of their work. So I found that helped me. Of course, you know, I showed up in LA in my 30s.
Right.
I remember the first time I got there, I think I was like 32, and I was going out for pilots, and they're like, hey, bad news. So they don't want to see you for this 23-year-old, fresh out of college tech nerd. And I'm like, great.
Great.
I don't want to do it. Well,
would have been here 8 years ago, you'd be all over movies like, I can't even remember the name of the movie. It slipped, but the one with, we'll forget it.
Yeah. The Intern? No, let's use the rest of this.
I was going to say, the rest of the time we just come up with whatever movie I was thinking about, right?
Dances with Wolves?
Close. A little bit more current, but that's all right.
Okay. I don't know. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Seth Green in it. Can't Hardly Wait.
Can't Hardly Wait.
You could have been Seth Green in that.
Oh, man.
I'm really dating myself.
I have the ski goggles.
Tim Baltz is in studio. Joliet Native, who is the co-creator and lead actor in the new CISO show, Shrink, which comes out Thursday. All the episodes come out at once. CISO, of course, the great streaming network that's owned by NBC Universal. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Tim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here. 720, Tim Baltz in studio. Tim, of course, a longtime Second City guy, Joliet native, who is the star, co-creator of the show Shrink, which debuts this week on CISO. Great to have you in studio, man. I've been a long time fan of yours, but
likewise,
Second City,
man.
And in Hollywood. So let's talk about Shrink. Where does this come from? Where's the idea? I mean, you talked about your co-creator really having the idea, but what's your experience with therapy? I mean, this is really sort of a send-up in a very grounded way of that industry.
Yeah, it is. And it follows David's path. The genesis of it started with one of Ted Tremper, who's the other co-creator, one of his friends who had graduated from medical school, didn't match with the residency program, because you basically, you know, once you graduate, you have to almost apply again to medical school.
Right.
This guy, $500,000 in debt, doesn't get in, and basically just goes and lives in his parents' garage. I mean, in his parents' basement for a year. And then that guy is fine now. He became a pathologist. He's
he made
fine.
It.
But Ted and I, through mutual experiences in therapy, you know, thought, okay, well, this could be a great way to use improv and a great way to kind of to play with this. And like you were saying earlier, you know, it's therapy does mirror a lot of what improv is, because there's a lot of listening. You have to really process all these things. You know, you don't know where your thoughts are going to go. You're always in a constant state of discovery, hopefully. And the first time I went to therapy, I, you know, again, I thought I never would do it. But I had friends who basically, I went through a breakup and one of my best friends was like, dude, it's been a year. I'm tired of hearing about this. And then another friend was like, yeah, she's right. Here's the card to my therapist. Why don't you go talk to an impartial third party so that we don't have to hear about this anymore.
Do this every Tuesday at 4 o'clock. Yeah. Don't do it here. Right.
And I actually worked right behind you.
Yeah,
I worked at 401 North Michigan, and my therapist was across the river.
Yeah, there you go.
And she was great. She was fantastic, and she helped me a lot. I grew up half French in Joliet, Illinois, so I had a lot to talk about. And I really valued those experiences. And I noticed the patterns too, you know, because you'll have a discovery, and then you'll kind of like regress on the discovery. You'll make one step forward, two steps back, you know. And it was fascinating to me how people wanted to be helped at times and how they didn't really want to be helped at times.
Yeah,
they just
right.
wanted a sounding board.
Well, I mean, for you as a comic to be in an improvised scene where you're a therapist and there's a patient, the patient's job in this game is to throw out funny, outlandish stuff to you. You know, TJ Jagodowski's in it, he's great right away about food stuff, things like that. Not only do you not, you can't crack up, right?
Yeah.
You know, right? You have
no,
to go with it.
Can't break.
But you're the ultimate straight man in the fact that you have to, because of the how we know therapy, you have to recognize it. You have to affirm it. You have to make it something real. And there's something beautiful in that comedy because you really can't say no. You don't have that.
Right.
That's not how therapy works.
No. You have to kind of honor the emotional truth of what they're saying, you know, in order to help build their idea. Of course, my character, David Tracy, is bad at it. So
I don't think he's bad at it. I think he's great at it.
He's well-intentioned.
Right.
He's very well-intentioned, and he's determined to be good at it.
which I like that.
Yes. But at times, you know, he can't help but see, like, oh, I see a problem. I want to help. And a lot of therapists, you know, they stay in the back seat. They let you drive the car in order to find the discoveries yourself because it's more powerful for you to do that, and you'll learn more, and you'll remember the lesson more. David is a bit eager, and I don't think he even understands the patience of that yet,
right?
And that is something that slowly dawns on him throughout the course of the season.
He learns how to be a therapist.
He does.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
The relationships in the first episode really have to do with your brother, who's hilarious.
Yeah.
Who's in the unsanctioned tanning oil business.
Yeah.
Your
Kyle Moore.
Your parents, which is great. And Joel Murray.
Joel Murray, Second City alum.
Yeah.
Megan Fay, actually from Joliet and Second City alum.
But there seems to be a lot. I mean, another way that this is grounded and it feels very Chicago is that it isn't just the gag in the garage.
Right.
You're not just doing the therapy. I mean, there's relationships that surround you. You have to deal with relationships of being back in your house. You have to deal with the relationship with your old therapist. I mean, there's a lot in it that is grounded in real relationships. Is that on purpose to play this in more of a dramedy kind of way than sort of a send-up, if you will, of therapy?
Yeah, it gave us the flexibility, you know? So you have all the laughs that come from therapy, and you have the emotional weight that comes from that as well, but you don't want to... You also are invested in this main character, what his journey is, the struggle that he's undergoing because he is in $500,000 of debt, the burden that places on his family, the fear, the anxiety of all that. You know, he had a plan. His plan A was become a doctor. He comes from a blue-collar. We shot it up in Albany Park. He comes from a blue-collar family, and he had a chance to become a doctor, and that didn't happen. So we follow his life. We follow his relationships. He's just gone through a breakup with a girl that he went through medical school with. You know, his life was set, and he gets put in check, and he has to deal with that. So a big component of it is the therapy because that's his job.
Right.
But you could say that this is like other shows that follow someone who has a job, and it's really about his life. It's about the fallout of him, his plan A.
And how he climbs up.
Yeah.
Tim Balton Studio, you know, for you, you spent a lot of time here, obviously, from Joliet, spent a lot of time in Chicago at Second City. What's it mean for you to shoot this in Albany Park, to shoot this in Chicago, to have it be a Chicago show?
It meant the world to us. You know, and when we first sold it, that was part of selling it, you know, because Chicago was a character in the show itself.
Dude, does Hollywood listen to that? Did they go, yeah, great, we love Chicago. They're like, yeah, all right. Every guy comes from everywhere, wants to shoot it where they're from.
Yeah, they don't always, but we're lucky in this town. And, you know, if we had shot it right after we sold it in 2013, I don't know if we would have been able to do it here. And now we can because of all the shows that shoot here. All the NBC shows.
Right.
What that does is that has taught all the actors here that are great at theater how to play small on camera. And that's something that you'll hear from the casting directors.
Oh,
and you'll hear that from people out in L.A. too. There's like these...
So they retrained the acting community here.
And now people don't have to leave, they don't want to. But it's also, you know, back then there might have been... Well, I can't speak to it, but now there are like 5, 6, 7 A-list crews just... like for production floating around the city.
Where there might have been, yeah, we all saw Project Greenlight.
Yeah.
There were one or two when, you know, like Pete Biagi and that's it. Right.
And now they're incredible. I mean, if we had sat down and drawn up, like, here's the best case scenario, we didn't have the imagination to predict how good it went.
Oh,
every department that we had was an A-plus department. We had Dana Scott, who was our line producer, who worked on Sirens, which is on USA Network. We had Brett Tanzer, who was our art department. I mean, I could talk about all the people in every single department, but they were A plus, and they made the show look great. Our director of photography was this guy, Chris Teague, who did Obvious Child, which was with Jenny Slate, one of my favorite comedies the last five years. So we, you know, that set the bar. And once you attract production talent like that, people feel safe and they join the project, you know?
Well, my last question for you, really, I mean, you've gotten something that a lot of people don't usually get the chance to do, which is to co-create, to create, be in, and sort of be around your own idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hollywood, you can find yourself as good as the work is, you know, doing feature roles on show after show after show and getting a name and a career doing that. But a lot of times you never get a chance to create your own material. What's it mean to you to have this success, to have this debuting on Thursday on CISO, something that is really, you know, your brainchild?
It's surreal. It's a dream. And it was a ton of work. I worked 9 straight 90-hour weeks at one point. I got real sick right at the end of production. I had to have a doctor come to set and shoot me full of antibiotics and steroids and B12 just to get the horse to the finish line. But it means so much, in part because it was so difficult, in part because we sold it over 3 years ago and we had to just sit there, and that was really frustrating. And to get to do it, and then to get to do it in this perfect way that we couldn't have even imagined, in the city of Chicago, we had great weather, with all these people that we find so talented. You know, you mentioned TJ Jagodowski, Dave Pasquese,
Claudia Wallace.
Sue Gillen plays the supervising therapist.
She's great.
These people that were my heroes coming up in this community, and then peers that were just, you know, contemporary heroes of mine, and then people that are younger than the generations going back to the early 80s all the way to people that still live here, like Emma Pope and Mike Brunlieb, who are touring at Second City, who are great people. I don't know. I love this town. I love that we got to showcase it. And this town makes it easy to showcase itself because there's so much talent in front of and behind the camera.
Tim Baltz is the co-creator of Shrink. It's on CISO. It starts on Thursday. They're going to put out all the episodes at once. If you want to watch it right now, you can go to Amazon. You can watch the pilot episode. That's what I watched last night. Tim, longtime Second City guy who is a Joliet native. Congratulations, man. That's awesome. And it's awesome that you came in studio. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, the band The Walters in studio. You're excited about this. They are ready to rock. They are getting ready for the sound check here. They're going to be our guests at Studio 435. They got a show coming up at Metro this week. Also talk about their music, their single. Lots of good stuff to talk to with the band tonight. Also coming up, we're off tomorrow night, the Blackhawks. And then on Wednesday... we will be back in studio. So we got a lot to do this week on the show, on the Download. Whatever you do will be insignificant, but it's very important that you do it. That's a quote from Gandhi, but it was shared by my friend Amy Krauss-Rosenthal. Amy Cross Rosenthal spent the better part of today trending on the internet, mostly because of a story she wrote last week in the New York Times. She asked if anyone wanted to marry her husband because Amy K.R. was dying. It was classic Amy, making people cry, laugh, and smile at the same time, talking about emotions, but really bringing us together to talk about love, to talk about death, but most of all, life. I met Amy Krauss Rosenthal as a 21-year-old producer. She wrote a funny essay. She was good at it. At the time, I would have no way of knowing that I'd spend the next 21 years working with her. Amy's a writer by trade, but a creator by heart. She was, she's written so many memoirs. One's alphabetized, by the way. Several great children's books. Little Pea, Spoon, It's Not Fair, just to name a few. She became a New York Times bestseller and a heavyweight in the kid lit world. But that was just one way you'd know her. If you were from the Chicago arts community, chances are you crossed paths with Amy Cross Rosenthal. Amy and I worked on a show called Writer's Block Party at WBEZ, the public radio station here. We sold it as a 5 to 7 minute variety show that would air within another show. The premise was pretty simple. You pack as much creative goodness into as little time as possible. And it was so fun. Amy would get accomplished writers and performers side by side with new artists and edit and direct them to perform these tiny little pieces, 1 minute essays, etc. And that list included writers like Bill Zemi or Elizabeth Crane or Sarah Karp or Tony Rogers, Megan Stielstra, so many. And it helped launch the careers of great writers like John Green or Claire Zulke or Mark Baser, just to name a few. It was just one of several projects that I worked with her on, radio, video, writings, and performances. I spent many a day sitting next to Amy, editing audio or discussing the right running order. She was a great producer, a great creative force. After all, she was Chicago, and she had that Chicago hustle. So no project was ever too big or ever too hard to accomplish. I've had a hard time articulating Amy's strength as a writer, maybe because it's not really about writing. See, Amy was on a mission. And that mission was to get us to all stop just for a second to recognize that there was beauty nearby. Here's a clip from when I sat down with Amy on the download a few months ago. When you think about the writing that you put out and the projects that you choose to work on and the ideas you choose to execute, what keeps bringing you back to the idea of community, connectedness, and togetherness?
Justin, that's such a good question. I wish I had the perfect answer. All I can tell you is that when I sit down to write every day, and this has always been the case, it's what do I feel compelled to write? Also, what am I capable of writing, right? I mean, that's part of the process. There's a lot that I can't do. There's a lot that I can't write. What can I write? What do I want to write? What's the urge? And sometimes, you know, the passages are small moments and they might seem kind of silly and or you know, very small. And other times I may tap into something that's bigger, grander, that is a universal truth about something. But whatever it is, you can be sure that I felt that was the sentence I needed to write that day.
You know what? We live our lives. There were moments we skip, we ignore, or we just plain dismiss. Amy did a bulk of her work forcing us to stop and recognize these moments, to share in a quirky wordplay or to leave us behind notes on grocery shelves or other odd places. She dedicated her life to making us look closer at ours. I'll give you an example of some of the tremendous stuff Amy Cross Rosenthal worked on. Always Trust Magic. It was an interactive video project where she'd leave notes on ATM machines. So she'd go to random ATM machines and just put the note on there saying, "You're beautiful," or something else uplifting. And she'd ask her readers to do the same. And after that, we'd get videos and pictures from around the world, people writing all these notes in different languages and far-off lands. It was tremendous, and it was magical. And Amy, she also loved numbers. She loved to play with the meanings around certain numbers, loved celebrating them. Like on October 10th, 2010, she did 20, she did 10, 10, 10. She told her audience to show up at 10:10 p.m. on 10:10:10 down at the Bean for a celebration. Again, I was hesitant. I was like, who's going to come down at 10 o'clock at night on a side? It was a Sunday. Who'd want to do that? And I was wrong. I'm still amazed that 1,000 people showed up to celebrate this once-in-a-lifetime moment with Amy. Or what about the time she asked her audience to meet her at the Belmont L stop on a Saturday morning? They were going to ride around the loop and back to Belmont. The project was called Going Nowhere Fast. And I really thought there'd be nobody. And it was like a lot like this. It was snowy. It was March. I just felt like, once again, it's not going to work out. And lo and behold, hundreds of people showed up and hopped the Brown Line for stories, a sing-along, and a shared moment. And when train arrived back at Belmont, everybody left.
A sing-along, and we want people to come together.
Oh, since the day I saw you, I have been waiting for you. You know I will adore you till eternity. So won't you please be my little baby? Say you'll be my darling.
I don't know.
It's B and A.
B and A.
And then A and B.
If you can sing it, I'll play it.
All right. Let's do this.
All right.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like me.
Tearing me apart.
This is a Brown Line train.
You can hear the Brown Line in the background there. And I could go on. I really could. And Amy did hundreds of these ideas throughout the years, and I consider myself to be lucky enough to even be a part of it. Because at a very young age, Amy proved to me that you could be creative, that you don't have to put your ideas away. You don't have to keep them bottled up. You're a creator, and your job is to create. And that's an unbelievable lesson to teach, especially to a 21-year-old kid. Amy Krauss Rosenthal died today from cancer. She leaves behind a loving family, a grateful artistic community, and a world that will always trust magic. Amy ended every episode of Writer's Block Party by saying,
"As for me, Amy K.R., this isn't goodbye. Just so long for now."
Everybody knows it sucks to grow up. And everybody does. So weird to be back here. Let me tell you what. The years go on and we're still fighting it. We're still fighting it. You'll try and try. And one day you'll fly away from me.
But Amy, this isn't goodbye. It's just so long for now. Coming up, the band The Walters live in Studio 435. It's a download, 720 WGN. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. On Friday, I'm still working this out. There's we're only on Monday, Wednesday, Friday this week. But I'm going to try to get a bunch of writers and creative people to come in on Friday. I know it's St. Patrick's Day, but I feel like it would be great as an honor to Amy to have them all, you know, either read some of her work or possibly read the work that they collaborated with her on and do a writer's block party live here as part of the download. What do you think, Pete? Do you think that's a good idea?
Love it.
Yeah, I mean, we might run into a little bit of holiday stuff. Do people do it? Do people do stuff on actual St. Patrick's Day? Has it just been totally lost by the idea that young people go party in Wrigleyville?
I think, you know, yesterday, you know, Sunday, the South Side, and Saturday, the Downtown. I think those are the two big days. But, you know, your hardcore probably still will extend it to Friday.
But it's not like a religious, like a Jewish holiday where you're like, no, I can't do anything except atone.
No.
So that you can still listen to the radio. Or
yeah.
If you were a performer, an Irish performer, you could still come and do a piece.
Sure. I would guess.
I don't know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 42-year-old man who does not know the rules of St. Patrick's Day.
You if you gave up, or, you know, during Lent, you're not supposed to eat meat.
Right.
But on St. Patrick's Day,
you can eat corned beef?
You're absolved if it happens to be on a Friday during Lent.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is the good, yeah, things are looking up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking on Friday, I'm going to start working on that tomorrow. Because I think that would be good. I think that, you know, it's just so interesting to me because Amy means a lot to a lot of people in Chicago. And the piece in the New York Times was just so touching, and everybody knows it. But, I mean, I saw Chicago publications today, broadcasters, saying essentially, woman from New York Times article dies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, she like has done a lot more than that piece. And that's a tremendous piece. And I get the idea of it being viral. That was somewhat of
great.
Its intention. It was,
mm-hmm.
it was a great piece. But the idea that that's a final chapter as opposed to the whole book.
Right.
And, you know, she's got so many projects. I haven't even talked about, I barely even mentioned, scratched the surface about the children's books. People listening tonight, I mean, if anyone who has small children, I mean, knows Amy's work from Little Pea and Duck Rabbit, Spoon. And it's funny because I remember when Amy would start to, when she started that work, right? I knew her before she became like a children's author. And then that happened and she had I forgot the first one, but she had a huge success. Might've been Little Pea, but it was a huge success. So she quickly like boom, 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 boom. And before you know it, like in the span of a year, she had four or five books out that were like the hot items at the children's store. And I remember I was in the, maybe it was in Bucktown. And I walked in and I think it was maybe it was right before my son was born. So we were looking at the stuff in the room and I saw her book, like her books were on the shelf. And, you know, if you've ever been to a bookstore, a children's bookstore, you know that there's just like a massive amount of books. You really got to look for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do is I'd pull hers out just a bit, little bit more than everybody else.
Oh, very nice.
So if someone was coming in, they're like, oh, this is, what's this one hanging? Oh, I'll get this one. Right? So she can thank me. For at least, I'm hoping that worked at least twice, right? I would do that wherever we went when we were having our baby. I just remember that. Like, I'm going to help Amy.
Yeah,
out.
Tip the scales.
Tip the scales, you know, in her favor.
It could be like from number one to number two of the New York Times bestseller
right,
list.
Right? And then she had so much success from the children's books that there was a massive billboard on the Kennedy. It was not, I always remember seeing it from Elston because I used to take Elston up, you know, never take the Kennedy, take Elston. And it was a Banana Republic. And it was a woman reading to her kid. Like, and it was all about, hey, look at the new khakis. Read the kids in your new khakis. I think that's what it was about. And the book that she was reading was Amy's book. And she's like, yeah, they like called and did the whole thing like to, I mean, you don't even think about that. Like what's
yeah.
in a picture that would be in a billboard that would be on the Kennedy. And it was essentially she got placement in this billboard. So, like, imagine if you're a writer, a local writer, and you're in the Banana Republic, and they're trying to sell Chico's, what do you call them, like capri pants, right? Hopefully someday our radio program can be on the back of something being sold. I'm guessing a Kohl's. Strong, like, you show me and Pete doing a segment while someone's trying to buy, you know, Wranglers. I don't know what the direct one-to-one would be, but yeah. So I mean, Amy has had, she had a ton of success, and like I said in the piece, she leaves behind a tremendous family and a tremendous artistic community that is forever indebted. John Green, I mentioned in the piece, John has been a guest on the show. He came up through Amy, and you know, he's had such success with Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns and other books that were turned into movies. And he's sort of like the go-to young adult author. And he said today, her genius was in her generosity. That's what he tweeted. And there's something to that. The idea that this person spent a lot of her time creating work by propping up other writers. You know, and I saw it firsthand. Like, these kids would come in. John was one of them. They would come into the studio, and the first time they've ever recorded, they've ever been in front of a microphone, anyone's ever taken a shot on anything, you know, and they would sit there with Amy, and Amy would be like, all right, are we ready to go? And I would be the guy behind the bike, and, you know, you've been there, and they put the microphones on, and then, you know, they'd read it the second time and third time, and they were, you know, there's something about the confidence,
yeah,
that comes with that, right? Now John is like, hey, I've got this opportunity. I succeeded in this moment. It's not unlike we were talking about with Tim. If you get to a certain point, you got to be ready, you know? When you get called on to be clerk number two and they're like, you want to read for Jonah? You got to be ready. So we feel like there's a lot of writers like that from John and a ton of people that I didn't even mention that have been on that program that had their first shot, you know, through Amy. So she will be missed. All right, coming up, Studio 435, the Walters. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. And tonight, the indie rock sounds of the Walters. The Walters just released a new single called She's Gonna Leave You. They're about to head out on their first national tour, but they'll be at the Metro on Thursday with the Orwells. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Kosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, and Charlie Eckhouse, and they are in studio around the table right now. You guys are on fire. The Walters are hot, and they're ready to get hotter, right?
Reckon hot.
Oh, yeah.
Well, before we hear music from you guys, I mean, this is, it's such a great time to have a band in studio. On Thursday, you guys are out on tour for 3 months. Talk about this. Talk about the idea of putting a tour together and what you have to do as musicians, but also as, I guess, people to get ready for a 3 month tour.
We don't know what to do, man. This is going to be an experiment.
We actually just started band therapy, so we're trying to, you know, keep it together.
It's a good thing,
know?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is a big, I mean, we were talking about this in the break. I mean, to be young musicians, you guys are all right around 25 years old, to make the move to go on a three-month tour, you got to put a lot of things aside, like day jobs and apartments and all this kind of stuff. I mean, talk about that. Let's talk about, like, Charlie, I know you're going to have to give up a day job to do this.
Yeah, I'm going to have to leave a day job, but it's going to be fun and, you know, I don't know. Looking forward to traveling. And
there's a lot of artists that's the crux. You're at the crux. You're right now making a decision. I and so many comics and actors who say, you know what, it's time to go to L.A., man. It's time to go to New York. I'm changing my life. This is that moment for
you
guys.
This is the jump off for us. So
what goes into that? Do you have good positive forces in your life? They're like, do it, or is it against the grain? Or people are like, no, Charlie, don't do it.
No, there's a lot of support. We all have a lot of support from our families and, you know, I don't think we'd be here without them. And
mm-hmm. I got a newborn baby. He's going to live with my parents for a couple
really?
Months. So, yeah.
There you go. See,
that's big, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, the stakes get a little higher over yeah. here, huh? Well, congratulations on a newborn.
Yeah,
what's
thanks.
It mean for you, though, to jump out and do this passion play? I mean, you guys are The Walters are hot. We'll hear the music in just a second. But, I mean, this is a big moment for you, too.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, man. It's tough leaving him for this long, but it's going to be good in the long run. So it's going to be fun, too.
We hope.
Yeah.
We're banging. Good to put that in there.
Yeah. So let's talk about the music, guys. I mean, you guys have been together just over 2 years' time. You guys have done a couple mini albums. You've done single. You put the single out. A new album is on the way. You guys are working on it right now. Talk about your sound and what makes you guys unique. We're going to hear you right after the break here, but what do we need to know about the Walters?
Well, the Walters, we like to, you know, bring back a lot of the, you know, the old and a lot of like the beachy kind of things of the past. 60s vibes, but kind of reinvented with the help of Charlie, our drummer who produces us. He's kind of brings this new age thing to it. But yeah, it's kind of laid back. Me and MJ switch off with the vocals, and it's a lot of back and forth. And then we have our master, Walter, shredding on the lead guitar. So he takes away a lot of pressure.
I've been hot, right?
Yeah. I don't know. It's like the Walters is music that like your dad or grandma might actually enjoy.
Well, there you go. Where's it come from? I mean, Charlie, you know, you were sort of checked as the guy who produces the sound. Why go with that sound? I mean, that's a sound that, you know, is obviously iconic, but it's a sound from the past. What do you do to make it the future?
Ooh. That's a tough question.
Well, I mean,
Ableton.
I think it came about. We weren't really trying to go for anything specific, but that was kind of just the sound that came out of us as a collective of individuals. And we've kind of just ran with it.
All right, let's take a break. We'll get the sound check in the break, and then we will hear live music from the Walters. They just released a new single in January called She's Gonna Leave You. They're gonna be at Metro on Thursday. The Walters, of course, Luke Olson, Walter Kosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, and Charlie Eckhouse. We will take a quick break here live from Studio 435, and we will hear music from the Walters. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, of course, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, the indie rock sounds of the Walters. They just released a new single called She's Gonna Leave You. They're about to head out on their national tour, but before they do that, they're going to be at Metro on Thursday with the Orwells. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Kosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, and Charlie Eckhouse on the drums. And here is the song, I Love You So.
I just need someone in my life to give it structure, to handle all the selfish ways I'd spend my time without her. You're everything I want, but I can't deal with all your lovers. You're saying I'm the one, but it's your actions that speak louder. Giving me love when you are down and need another. I've got to get away and let you go. I've got to get over. I love you.
Yeah. Yeah. There it is. Come on back to the table, guys. The Walters in live studio 435 tonight. I love you so. The Walters, Luke Olson, Walter Costner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, Charlie Eckhouse. They are going to be at Metro on Thursday night with the Orwells. Jump on back in. That's great, guys. Yeah, you can tell. You can hear that kind of like very sort of, you know, almost like a traditional ballad, if you will. You know, that's
the, thank you.
So let's talk about the music some more. You guys, you know, have been putting out sort of mini albums, EPs, and the single, of course, and you're working on new material. When you go out on tour like you're going on Thursday, how much of it is material that you have already worked out, a set list that you worked out here in Chicago? You know what you're going to play, and how much of it is working with the new music that you guys are working on?
For this tour, a lot of it's going to be the stuff that we've already had out. Because there's so many people that have been waiting to see us live. So we definitely want to play the songs that they've, you know, already grown to love. And then we mix in a few newer ones, I guess.
How do you guys keep that fresh? I mean, is that something that as musicians, I always wonder about that. Like as musicians, do you get to a point when you're in week two of a tour and you're like, let's try that other song. Like, yeah. How does that work?
Well, we don't really know yet, but
Strong drugs.
I think that the songs, the way we play them live, are like a lot different than the way they're recorded anyway. So hopefully it'll be fresh for people who haven't seen us yet.
You know, for you guys, you just mentioned the idea that a lot of people want to see you live. And you're talking about an audience that you guys have been able to harness and develop because of the internet. I mean, it's changed the way music is. But a lot of people know your stuff that might be living in Milwaukee or other places that might be further away that have never seen you guys before. You know, when you talk about that, the idea that the music sounds different than how you recorded it and did it live. I mean, do you try when you're introducing your music to someone who knows it specifically only from Bandcamp or from wherever to your live sound? Do you think about trying the consistency and making sure that it sounds similar?
You know, like we made our first album without ever playing together live, which is... Wow, kind of different than how most people go about it. So some of the songs naturally changed when we practiced them because we kind of wanted to do different things because it's fun to get louder, you know. But I think we've made changes to songs in the past. So some songs we play now, we used to play live and they're totally different. So it's just always different.
Do you guys consider yourself, I mean, it's such an interesting time to be musicians with the fact that you can produce material and put it up on your site and you don't have to spend a million dollars to put something together. Do you guys consider yourselves a studio band, a live band? Where do you consider yourself at your strength?
Well, they're both equally different. And some people will say they'd rather see us live than listen to the recordings, but... I mean, we started off studio based, like Walter said, but our live show has, you know, garnered some success just because people keep coming to see us in Chicago. the live show is a lot more energetic. Walter usually takes his shirt off, so...
In the studio or on stage?
On stage. Yeah.
Studio gets awkward, but on stage, perfect.
On stage, that's our secret weapon. If we're ever really need it
really
and
need
we're
push.
Really tanking, right. Walter takes his shirt off. But
it happens every show, so I guess we always tank.
Well, I mean, you guys talk about playing live here in Chicago. I mean, where's the best place to see the Walters? Where do you guys like to play the most?
We did like the Double Door, but I guess that's not open anymore.
Over, yeah.
We're fans of Shuba's, Lincoln Hall. Hopefully we played at Metro early on in our career. It wasn't our shining.
There's like 10 people there. Yeah. Really
sad, well, that's good because you can make your return on Thursday. You know.
We'll show those 10 people.
We'll show those. At least double, you're still on your way, right? That's how it works. It's good. Yeah. In studio with us tonight, Studio 435, the band The Walters. Their single you can find, She's Gonna Leave You. They got new material which should be coming out this year. They're about to head out on a national tour, but before they do that, they will be at Metro, which is sort of like, I would say, like the going away party. Like that's a jam, like that's for all your Chicago faithful to come out and have one last party before you guys get in the van and head
and then after party at Chop Shop.
Oh, there you go. There,
is that happening?
Yeah.
Is that happening? I love it. Like a band meeting here.
There's a pre-party, too, at Gingerman.
G-Man.
Yeah.
G-Man.
All right, so G-Man Metro, and then Chop Shop. Got it. The Walters
then
are Luke.
Hopefully not going to jail.
Yeah. Well, after the party, there's the hotel lobby, but that's a different thing. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Cosner, and Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, Charlie Eckhouse. And we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update with Rob and the news, and we'll come back. We got two more live songs here at Studio 435. Stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435, the best live performance Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. A guest in studio tonight, and this is very exciting to have him here. The Walters, they're about to head out on a national tour, their first one. Very exciting to be here. I feel like I'm a part of it already, so that's good. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Cosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, Charlie Eckhouse. They're playing at Metro on Thursday, pre-party at G-Man, after-party at Chop Shop. A lot going on with this band, but they're about to perform again here in Studio 435. Here is the track, Sweet Marie. Take it away, guys. In studio 435. I love it. The track Sweet Marie. The Walters, Luke Olson, Walter Cosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, Charlie Eckhouse. They just released a new single, She's Gonna Leave You, but they are about to head out on a national tour. First, they'll be at Metro on Thursday with the Orwells. Why don't we do this? Why don't we take a break, Pete? Why don't we do that? We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk some more, and then we'll hear one more track with the Walters live at Studio 435. Stay with us. Welcome back to Studio 435, here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, in studio, the indie rockers, the Walters. They are going to be at Metro on Thursday night with the Orwells. They're about to head out on a national tour. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Cosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, and Charlie Eckhouse. They are around the table here. We'll hear one more track before we wrap up here. You know, we were talking in the break. Last week we had the punk band Absolutely Not on the program in Studio 435. And it wasn't the first time we talked about, but they talked about house shows in Chicago. You know, and when I asked you guys about house shows, your face lit up. I mean, this is something you guys know as well. I'm just to refresh the memories of people who might be listening. This is the idea of DIY shows that are done in living rooms and basements around the Chicago area. But it used to be sort of, hey, that's what I do because I'm a teenager and I you know, when my friend's over, when my parents are out of town, right? That's sort of the, mm-hmm. the 90s stereotype that I'm throwing out. But it has become like its own circuit, like in the way that bands come up and out of that and they're ready, they're battle-tested, they're ready to go. Talk about your guys' experience with house shows.
Well, the first two shows we ever played were house shows. I mean, we've played quite a bit of house shows. Yeah, man, that's how Chicago kind of works, I feel. You start getting hot in the house scene, and that really, you know, because, I mean, these kids, you know, you go to these parties, and whether a band's playing or not, it's usually a fun party. And then, you know, you play a show, and it's just rowdy, and it's something I feel like people just, like, always have a good feeling about, you know.
And these are, I mean, mostly in Chicago. I mean, is there a suburban, sort of circuit as well, or is it just Chicago?
I'm sure there is.
Yeah, I mean, the Orwells are from Elmhurst, and I think that they were doing that before they came down to the city in Elmhurst. But, I mean, in Chicago, it's just like a driving force behind the music scene here. Yeah, it just, you know, the venues, I feel like, are bringing in bands that appeal to these people in this DIY scene.
It's amazing to me, too, we were talking about last week, that, you know, they were code names for the houses and all this kind of stuff that they were bringing up that I had no concept. I mean, I really do. I want to show my age, but as a 40, you know, 2-year-old, I'm like, there's really? It's not just Jake? Jake and his roommates from Columbia throwing a party? I mean,
no, we know them.
You know them, yeah. I mean, it feels like it's much more sort of formalized than I would ever thought it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's like the people who, you know, run them, got their name for their spot, and, you know.
You don't post
shout out La Cubierta.
You don't post the address? No.
Yeah, it's very serious, man.
I love it. And there are, I mean, you guys, I mean, I'm only thinking the people we've had the conversation with, Absolutely Not. Twin Peaks was in here, and Twin Peaks talked about the house parties and getting their start at certain house parties in Logan Square or Rogers Park. I mean, this is, you're right when you say it used to be, and it feels like it might still be, but the idea that you'd want to play all these different rooms, you'd want to play Empty Bottle, and then you want to play Hideout, and maybe you want to play, I don't know what the other, you know, keep going through, and that's how a band got their name, but it truly is a different scene and a different way to get your name out in these days.
It's how you meet the bands, too. Like, you play a house show, and you meet bands, and they're like, yeah, we have a show at, like, we played Shuba's, our first venue show was Shuba's, and that's because we met the Orwells at a house show, you know?
That's great. I love it. I love Chicago.
Walter's really good, too. He's like... he's
everybody like loves Walter.
What's not to love?
Really, they really got a lane for you.
Well, it's like every house show has to have a theme, so if I'm there, that's a theme.
It's a theme. Walter. Walter's there. All right, you guys are working on a new album. What's it going to sound? I mean, is this a developing sound for you guys? Is it similar to what you guys have put out before? What can you tell us about the new album?
Well, it's in early development, but we're going to try to keep going on what we've started, you know, keep that sound rolling and hopefully not disappoint our fans.
Well, okay, you're going on how's this work? You're going on a 3-month tour starting on what, Friday?
Thursday.
So, how do you guys work on new material? I mean, you have to be disciplined enough to say, okay, let's all get together and work on this song? Or, is it essentially wake up, get to where you need to get, sound check, wake up, get to where you have to get, sound check? I mean, how do you work on new material when you're in the grind of a national tour?
We don't know yet.
It might be postponed until after.
I'll be disappointed in that if I don't hear that you guys did not also create the new record while you're on tour.
We've been putting some work in knowing that we were leaving, because we didn't know that we were going with the Orwells, you know, until, like, when did we find out?
Late January.
So, Yeah, we were planning on, you know, using that 2.5-3 months or whatever for working on the album. Mm-hmm. So when we found out we were going, we were like, okay, like let's get in the studio a little bit, get a few things right. started. And so once we come back, we'll be able to hit the ground running.
It's amazing. I mean, for you to be young musicians heading out for 3 months, and we talked about the commitments that you have, that you are, you know, you have to put on postpone or leave behind or family members, things like that. You know, when you talk about it as musicians, are you prepared for the, for, have you thought about the rigors of doing a show every other night and keeping yourselves somewhat, I guess the word would be healthy, like as you embark as a sort of rowdy rock band on the road?
We're bringing a lot of workout gear on the road.
Yeah, we got our BOSU ball. I don't know if you know what a BOSU ball is. Well, we swear by it.
Got a kombucha cooler?
Kombucha, a lot of kombucha. Yeah.
I have different essential oils. We can...
Right.
You
got
it. Lavender.
Eucalyptus.
No, it sounds like you guys have taken this real serious. I no doubt about it. You got it figured
Walter's
out.
Walter's been packing for like...
5 years.
He just started packing before we even started the band. He was like, I know I'm going to be going.
Well, I feel like board. I feel like a new segment of checking in with the band, checking in with the Walters every other week to see how you guys are doing. Like a reality, yes. Like a documentary.
We'd be open to it.
All right, good, good. That's good. I'm going to take you up on that. All right, what you guys got one more song in you. What are you guys going to play tonight?
Last song is called What's Left. And MJ is going to take the lead vocals on
All
this
right.
one.
What's Left, the Walters. I jump up and they're getting in position here in Studio 435. They're going to perform What's Next. The Walters, you can find their music. They just released a single in January called She's Going to Leave You. And they're about to head out on a national tour. They kind of started on a Metro on Thursday with the Orwells. That's who's they're on tour with. The Walters are Luke Olson, Walter Kosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, and Charlie Eckhouse. And here they are with the last track at Studio 435. You guys ready? Take it away.
Left round here.
Walters in Studio 435. They're at Metro on Thursday night with the Orwells. They are Luke Olson, Walter Cosner, Michael Tirabassi, Danny Wells, Charlie Eckhaus. They are about to head out on their national tour. And if we can play our cards right, we'll get an update with them in a couple weeks. Find out where they're at. It's a pleasure, guys. Thanks for coming in and being part of Studio 435. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Man.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN. We're out tomorrow night. Actually, we're in for an hour tomorrow night, right? That's fun. Marty DeRosa and Erica Reed are going to be my guests for The Worst. We'll play The Worst tomorrow night. That'll be fun. Also on Wednesday, this will be fun too, Giselle Potter and Heidi Stillman. Giselle Potter is a great children's book author, and Heidi Stillman is the artistic director at the Looking Glass Theater. Talk about their show, The Year I Didn't Go to School, A Homemade Circus, which is at the Ruth Page Center, which is getting great reviews. Chris Jones was like, he was giddy. I could feel it through the words of the review. And we'll talk with them on Wednesday. And, of course, Greg Flamm will be here to do the swap meet. And then I think on Thursday, same thing. Like, Blackhawks are on the East Coast. They must be on the East Coast. They're playing early games. So we'll be back for the 10 o'clock hour. And then on Friday, like I said, we'll have that tribute to Amy Krauss Rosenthal. We'll bring some writers and some great talent in studio, and we'll make it happen.
It's a tour of Canada, I think. Montreal, okay. Montreal, Ottawa, and then Toronto.
All right, here comes the Canadian. That's right. You know what? I heard Coach Q today talking about that.
Yeah.
I should pay attention to the things that the coach says.
Eh?
Eh?